Where Nanda for bringing a little fluffy bunny along for us. So, because we didn't have a teddy bear, so we have a fluffy bunny. Oh, we have Teddy. Excellent. Where did Teddy come from? Is this somebody's guilty secret? Thank you so much. Okay. All right. Makes it so much easier. Okay. Maybe we could have Teddy sitting meditation at the seat over there, because he's only just ordained. If he could sit up there. Excellent. Oh, that's good. People bring their teddies to the retreat. We should have actually recommended it. Next time we'll do it, won't we? We can tell everyone to bring their teddy along. So we're now, believe it or not, entering the middle phase of the retreat. The last few nights I've talked quite specifically about the meditation technique. And outlined the way of practicing metta up to the doing metta for oneself and for a loved person. For this evening, I'm going to have a bit of a change of pace, and we're going to talk so much so specifically about the meditation technique in terms of the practice. For now, just keep on practicing as I've already talked about. And tomorrow night I'll move on to the neutral person, but for now just keep going with oneself and the loved one. What I wanted to do for this evening, instead of talking so directly about meditation, I wanted to offer a few reflections and a few thoughts that maybe put this practice into some kind of context. So I was very pleased a couple of weeks ago. I read a Buddhist document where I was actually referred to, and I thought, oh, that's very good. And I was referred to, and it said, Sujato is a heretic who will burn in hell. So I regard that as quite an achievement. I've finally attained the stage of being condemned by the fundamentalists. That's fantastic. So I suppose I'm not quite sure why I'm going to hell, but perhaps I'm going to hell because I've had the temerity to suggest that Buddhist scriptures have developed in a historical context, and that not every word in the Buddhist suttas can be literally ascribed to the historical Buddha himself. Perhaps I've been consigned to the reaches of hell for suggesting that there are genuine and authentic teachings of the Buddha found not only in the Theravadan school but also in other schools of Buddhism. Or perhaps I've been condemned to burn in the flames of the nether regions for supporting bhikkhuni ordination. I think any one of those would probably be enough to condemn me for at least an eon suffering in certain people's eyes. So, for most of us have kind of been exposed to and brought up in a kind of Buddhism which, well, we don't condemn people to hell, do we, very often? It's not something which is a kind of normal part of what we do. And when we're kind of exposed to this kind of thing, we're sort of almost like dragged back to this kind of dark ages, medieval kind of witch burning kind of mentality. And actually, it's not that uncommon. For example, I had a friend of mine, actually one of the bhikkhunis who was here for the ASA conference, and when she was in Vietnam, when she first ordained as a bhikkhuni, one of the monks said to her, "You're going to go to hell for ordaining as a bhikkhuni." It's quite a common kind of sort of conversational piece, you know. And her response was, "Well, if I'm going to go to hell, Bhante, it would only be because I'm going to visit you." So, yeah. So one of the things I wanted to reflect on or to raise into awareness in terms of our practice here during this retreat is this question, which I think is a very important one, and I don't think it's one which we should sort of neglect or just pass over casually. It's the question of what are we doing here? What is this thing we call Buddhism? What is this religion that we're here to practice? Now, I assume in a retreat like this, probably most people here would think of themselves as Buddhists. Probably some would not. Some might think of themselves as Christian or Hindu, perhaps, or agnostic or whatever. But in any case, we have certain beliefs, certain ideas, and those ideas shape the way that we practice, and they shape the actual form of our experience in one way or another. There was a very lovely saying by psychologist Carl Jung, and he's talking in the context of Christianity, and he said that, I can't quote him exactly, but this is something along the lines that the purpose of religion and the trappings of religion is to protect people, protect the followers of the religion from an experience of the divine. This is why we have all the symbols and the stories and the churches and things. They're supposed to be there. We think that they're there because they can bring us to God or to divine or whatever it is that we're looking for. Whereas in fact, what Jung was suggesting is that they very often form exactly the opposite. The church is not a house of God. A church is a prison for God. A church is somewhere that you can lock God up in and keep him safe for Sundays, and you can go in there for an hour on Sunday and do a kind of ritual where God's kind of under control and then leave and close the door behind you, and he's kind of kept safely there locked up. If you compare with many earlier religious forms, for example the Hebrew tradition, if you look in the Old Testament, you had this very kind of wild practice of kind of animal sacrifices. There's lots of blood daubed everywhere. Abraham is this kind of wild shamanic figure in the desert, wandering around with his goat herders and killing people left, right, and center, and then slaughtering animals on the shrine and daubing the animal blood over himself and everywhere. This is what's prescribed in the Old Testament. That's how they experienced their sacredness. It's very different from, you know, having tea and bickies with the vicar on the back lawn, yeah? A similar thing in the Indic tradition, in the very old Vedic tradition, long before the Buddha. They never had any temples or anything like that. They would always do their worship in the open air, in nature. And similar kind of animal sacrifices and so on. So it seems to me that this idea that Jung has expressed, it's not an absolute truth by any means, but I think there is some truth to it. If we look at Buddhism, so much of Buddhism all the world round is a cult of the dead. If you look in traditional Buddhism, for example, traditional Chinese Buddhism, very often people will, in China and places like that, will say it's almost like a kind of cultural truism that Buddhism is basically for death. That's what Buddhism's for. Yeah, you get the monks along or the nuns along to do the chanting at the funeral and so on and so forth, and that's really what that's for many people, is their only real encounter with Buddhism. And in the Buddhist temples we get, you know, things like the relics, which are the kind of the bones. And you put the relics under the stupa. And again, we think of a stupa as being something to commemorate the Buddha, which is of course one aspect of it. But another aspect of it, I think, is the reason why we have to build such big stupas and make them so heavy is because we need to keep the Buddha down. We need to trap him under there so he can't get out. Even the Buddha's bones have still got so much power in there, we have to sort of keep him under control. Because if we left the Buddha loose, who knows what could happen. You might think one of the good things about being in Buddhism is that you can say things like this, and well, people might say that you're a heretic and you'll burn in hell, but at least you're not going to get lynched or have a fatwa put on you or something like that. So that's good. You know, in Chan they have, of course, a very famous saying: if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Yeah. So that's one of the great things about Buddhism, that you can, I don't think any other religion you could say that. You know, you couldn't say if you meet Jesus on the road, kill him, right, could you? Or if you meet Muhammad on the road, kill him. You never find that in a Muslim text. In Buddhist texts you can say that and everyone goes, ah, yes, very profound. Meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, yes. Because no one quite knows what it means, but that's what makes it so profound, yeah. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. So do you know what it means?
If someone says they know the truth, don't necessarily believe them?
Uh-huh. That's partly, yeah. Well, it's a bit more specific than that, I think, though. Yeah. Because one of the things, of course, is the key to it, I think that for me, I mean, it's not meant to be a rational thing, but for me the key to it is that the Buddha is not on the road. The Buddha is at the end of the road. He's already completed the journey. So if you're walking along the road, whoever you meet, it's not the real Buddha. Yeah? Actually, the original context of it is talking about in meditation, that in meditation you can often have nimittas or images. And people, when they're meditating, they reach a sort of a certain level of meditation where they'll have an image, maybe an image of the Buddha or something like that. And people often take that to mean that they're enlightened or something that's got great significance. And so really that's the point of that saying, is just to kind of let go if you have these kind of images and so on. So what I'm suggesting in some way is that the externals, the forms and so on of a religion, their purpose is to insulate and to divert people's minds from the truth. You might think I'm exaggerating, am I? Just a minute ago we did our chanting. Yeah, and we did the chanting, the recollection of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Okay, yeah, you think about, just for a moment, what was going on in your mind then? What was the state of your mind while doing the chanting? And think, what was the state of your mind half an hour earlier when you were sitting in meditation? Yeah? Which point was more real? At which point did your mind have a closer and more direct connection with the actual truth of things, the actual reality of things? Yeah? Now, of course, this is not a black and white thing, and minds change, but I think for many of us, much of the time, we'd have to say, well, it's when we're sitting in meditation, isn't it? You're sitting in meditation, that's when our mind is really encountering the truth. Yeah? When we do the chanting, well, we're thinking about how to chant and are we going to fit in with everybody else? And how do you pronounce Pali anyway? And all of these kinds of things. And am I chanting out of tune? Does everybody... Yeah? So I'm not trying to denigrate it or criticise the practice of chanting. I'm just trying to point to that reality, that when we engage with the forms, the external forms of religion, that in many ways that's actually a distraction from the deep truth and the real truth, which is, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Actually, we need distractions. You can't just go around being confronted with the naked truth all the time. Yeah, it's too much. But I think it's important to reflect on it and reflect on how these things work. So one of the the themes that you notice in the Buddhist literature and the history of Buddhism is this repeated rebellion and revolution. Things get stuck. Things get caught up in forms. The religion becomes usurped by other interests, by nationalism or by sort of cultural preservation or something like that. And we lose touch with what's the essence of the Dhamma, what's the essence of the teachings. I remember that before the Buddha died, when he was lying there, according to the story in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, all of the devas came from all the four directions and thousands of devas were there. And they were singing and dancing, playing music. Interesting to know how devas celebrate a funeral. I think that would be a much better way of doing the funerals. So we have these kind of really kind of depressing funerals. I think a bit more singing and dancing would probably be good. So there they were. Actually, I did a funeral just a couple of weeks ago. This is entirely beside the point. But in an Anglican church, it was quite fascinating because it was a very traditional Anglican funeral and I hadn't seen one of those. And it was all kind of, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and Amazing Grace, and it was very, very traditional. And they had this opera singer, this fellow from Melbourne, who sang this stunning aria, this kind of thing. It was beautiful in this church and it was resounding and it was so inspiring and everything. And then they got us up to do our Pali chanting. Oh, that was a little bit embarrassing. But anyway, we did our best. But you can see, I could see even in that context, like the purpose of the conventions and the forms and everything is there to give to protect people, to hold people, the family and everybody. It kind of gives a container. So from time to time, the people in religious traditions get sick of these containers. They get sick of the constraints that's offered by them, and they just say, no, get rid of it all. Go out into the forest. Go into the mountains. Find a cave. Throw away the books. Just go back to the real practice. Oh, that's right, I got distracted there. I was going to say with the Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and as he was dying and all the devas came to celebrate his funeral. And you can imagine that. Imagine if, you know, thousands of devas came down and they're all flowers and everything. You'd go, wow, that's so amazing. It's just like Bollywood in real life. But what does the Buddha do? The Buddha goes, oh yeah, whatever. Yeah. He said, if you really want to worship me, practice what I taught. That's a real way to worship me, not all of this kind of stuff. So, of course, the response to that from the Buddhist traditions is to say, sadhu, 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 that's wonderful, that's so profound. Let's go and build another stupa to commemorate it. So there's always this kind of moment. And where you have to let go of all of those things, and you let go of those constraints and structures. And this is what it means, like the going forth. We talk about the going forth, but we talk about going into the forest. If you look at the biographies of the great Ajahns, Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Man and all of them, they all start out with a period of time in society, in where the religion is there to fulfill some kind of socially constrained role. For example, Ajahn Chah, when he was first ordained as a monk, spent the first few years staying in a village monastery in his home village. And just a little kind of monastery there, and he sort of practiced and tried to study Pali and grammar and all of these kinds of things, and doing the various duties and so on that were expected of him. But then after a while he kind of realized, hang on, the essence of the holy life is not about studying Pali grammar. So I'm sure any of you who've actually tried to study Pali grammar will agree with him. And threw away all the books, he went off into the forest. Interesting was that many years later, after he'd practiced for so many years, he built up his monastery of Wat Pa Phong and so on, he went back to that village monastery, and one of the last rains retreats he spent staying in that little village monastery in his home village. And many people wondered at the time why that was. Why did he go back there? And he just kind of announced it to the monks one day, just at the beginning of the rains. He just told everyone, by the way, I'm not spending the rains here. I'm going off and spending the rains at this little village temple. And a lot of the monks didn't know why, but it seems that the reason why he did that was because when he'd been staying there as a young monk all those years before, he'd told the villagers that he would build a new sala for them, a new hall. But then he'd never done it. He'd gone off into the forest to meditate. So when he went back there, so many years later, decades later, he built the new sala, yeah, got that arranged and got that done. So to me, that's a very nice reflection. you know, what is his kind of priorities and so on. He's not saying that, you know, building a new sala is a bad thing, or that these externals, these trappings of religions, are bad things in and of themselves. But it's saying that, well, put them into perspective. Yeah, what's really important? What's the real essence? One time when I was in Thailand, I stayed for a year in a hut by myself in a forest in the north of Thailand, in Nan province, and I used to go for get my meal in the local village, and walk in for alms around every day, and people would come, and the people in that village were very generous, and so I'd always have plenty to eat. And even though it's a very simple village, one day they had a festival of some kind. I'm not quite sure what kind of festival it was, but most of the villagers were all at this kind of clearing on the outskirts of the village, and they were all doing some kind of puja or festival or something. And part of the festival was that they had a table, and on the table they had some monk's bowls, and they were all coming up and putting food in these monk's bowls. And that, you know, how generous Thai people are. So of course they were, you know, the whole table was overflowing with these offerings of food and everything. But of course, because they were all in there, nobody was bringing out food for me. There weren't any monks there. There were just the bowls. So I was standing out the side with my bowl, thinking, "Hello, real monk here. Stomach this way." Everyone's over there very happily putting in food into the empty bowls. Or into the bowls with nobody there. I guess, I'm not sure, maybe they made more merit that way. You know, it's funny the things that people think of monks and what you're there for. I remember one time I was in the same hut. And I was the owner of the hut, and some of his workers came, and they made a walking meditation path for me one time. And so we made the path, and I paced it out, sort of how many steps long is the path after they'd finished it, and it was like it was 37 steps or something like that. So I just kind of paced it out to see how many. And then one of the workers who was there said, "How many steps is it?" I said, 37. He said, "Oh, okay." It went off. A couple of weeks later, the owner of the house happened to meet that worker somewhere, and he said to him, "Oh, that Western monk that you've got at that hut there," he said, "Yeah," he said, "he gives the best lottery numbers." He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Oh, I asked him how many steps his walking path was. He said 37. And he said, you know, he said he went back straight after that and he told all his friends and his families. He said, "Oh, listen, we've all got to buy the lottery number 37 this week, guaranteed." And all his friends and people said, "Oh, that's ridiculous. Don't be silly." So none of them did it. So he was the only one who bought it, and he won. Terrible, isn't it? And then the next day, after I heard that story, the next day I was walking for alms in the village, and there was one fellow in the village there who every day would come out and give a little bit of food, a little bit of sticky rice or something, and then go in. And I'd been going there for 6 months, 9 months. He'd never said a word to me. You know, some people don't say anything. They just come out and put the food in and that's it. And this was the first time, and he said to me, "Oh, Bhante," he said, "Bhante, how old are you, by the way?" Because I didn't think I'd have told him how old I was. He said, "Oh, okay." I said, "Well, hang on, why are you asking?" So this is why it's so easy to get caught up in those things. Yeah, little by little, you don't notice it. Yeah, little bit by little bit, the practice sort of disappears, and all of these things gradually reappear. It doesn't take long. Doesn't take long at all. It can happen very quickly. Yeah, within one person, you know, it can come very, very quickly. And we forget about what we're actually here for, and we start kind of insisting on all of those externals. Insisting, remember there's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada, it talks about the essential and the inessential, the sara and the asara. He said this is a person of wisdom who knows this is what is the sara, this is what is the asara, this is what is the essential, to know the difference between the essential and the inessential. So this is one of the meanings, I believe, this is one of the meanings of what, when it talks about the Buddha and his life, and he left home and went forth into the forest. The forest is a place where anything can happen. Yeah, the forest is where all of the constraints, the expectations, the conditioning of society, all the social expectations, everything, how we're expected to behave, what kinds of things we need to do, and all of those things that just disappear. Yeah, and we're just there, it's just us in the forest. And in that time, in that space in the forest, is where we can come back to and can confront the many primal fears that we have. If you look in the biographies of the great Ajahns in the Thai forest tradition, you'll find three essential elements in all of those biographies. Three primal terrors, the three great dreads that they have to overcome. Number one, ghosts. The fear of the dead. Spending the night in the cemetery. Number two, tigers. Yeah? The wild beasts ready to rip you limb from limb. And number three, most dreadful of all, the wife from your past lives. These three things, yeah. You find essential ingredients in any biography of the forest masters. So this is a little bit like what we've done here when we've come to Jhana Grove. Yeah. So okay, it's a little bit more civilized here. We still have, you know, Nutri-Grain at breakfast and stuff, heaters and showers and things. But it's a step towards it, isn't it? Yeah, we've stepped away from our conventional lives, stepped away from the 9 to 5, stepped away from the ordinary expectations, the distractions, everything. And things are much more open here. I believe very deeply that it's only when we step outside those structures that the really deep insights happen. And I believe very deeply that when the mind opens up, when the heart opens up, when wisdom arises, that this has really nothing to do with Buddhism. I guess this is, you could say this is the difference between Buddhism and Dhamma. And Buddhism is a particular historical tradition. It has its teachers, its lineage, its texts, its traditions, its languages, its devotions, and all of those other trappings, like any other religion. But then you have the Dhamma. And the Dhamma has none of those things. Dhamma just is. Dhamma is not bound to any place or time. Dhamma is not something which is It's not something which can be captured by the externals. It's something which is always very elusive. You know, one of the things in Buddhism I find very interesting, I'm sure many times you've probably heard in one way or another people say that that the essence of Buddhism is very simple, and that the truths of Buddhism are very simple. Just let go. And we've heard teachings like this many times. Well, to which my question is, if it's really so simple, how come the Buddhist scriptures are so big? How come Buddhists over the years have spent so much effort to write so many thousands of words to say something so simple? Don't you find that interesting? If it's really simple, can't you just put it in a few sayings and then just have that? That's all. Yeah, maybe we just need like the Dhammapada or something like that, and we don't need anything else. Maybe that's true. I don't know. Maybe. But somehow we seem to keep on wanting to make more and more and more books. You know, Buddhists have written so many books that it is actually, most people don't know of this. You see, most people, when we hear Buddhism taught, people say, oh, you know, Buddhism's all about the practice and blah, blah, blah. And we don't realize this. In history, in India, the Buddhist writing is the oldest writing in India. Okay, the oldest text of the King Ashoka's, the oldest substantial text, King Ashoka's pillars. The oldest manuscripts in India are also Buddhists. Yeah? So the Buddhists were the first to use writing in ancient India. The oldest printed book in the world is Buddhist Sutra from China. Yeah? The oldest printed book in the world with movable type is also a Buddhist Sutra from China. Yeah? So Buddhism has actually been driving information technology ever since it's been born. The invention of writing, invention of the birch bark manuscripts in India, printed type. Yeah? They're all Buddhist inventions. Why? Because there's so many books. You can't pay someone to copy them all down, so they had to invent the printing press to be able to print them all. Yeah? And so you can print all these books because it's very meritorious, and then you can make lovely copies, put them on the shrine, and then worship them. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You think I'm joking, don't you? If you read in the Sri Lankan Chronicle, in the Mahavamsa, it talks about how one of the narratives there is about how the Theravada kept the pure teachings and how these impure teachings kept on leaking in from the mainland. And one of the stories about that, it talks about this particular book which was brought over, and it's a kind of heretical treatise of some kind. We don't really know what it was. But if you look at the narrative, it's actually very interesting because it said it was brought over, it was brought in. The king took that book, he put it on the shrine, and he worshipped it. There's no mention of him actually reading it. Yeah? It's not a question of reading it, it's a question of worshipping it. Yeah? These things talked about again and again. If you look at the, say, Mahayana sutras and things like that, they're constantly talking about taking the sutras and worshipping them on shrines. Yeah? So this is how the truth is put out there. Yeah? It's not there's a big difference, isn't there, between the truth which you experience in here and the truth which you put out there. Yeah? So for myself, as someone who loves the Pali suttas, I love the early Buddhist scriptures, I love the Pali language, and I spend a lot of time memorizing the Buddhist scriptures, and spent many, many hours reciting and memorizing them. And I know that when you do that well, when you memorize, say, a sutta like the Buddha's second discourse, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, talking about not self and the five aggregates and so on, and it's very repetitious. It's the kind of sutta which, if you read on the printed page, you think, well, it's a bit kind of boring and it's a bit repetitious, and, you know, I got the point, so why do you have to keep telling me? But when you're reciting it, yeah, you you have that space. It's precisely because of the repetition and the rhythm. You have that space and you keep on reflecting, you keep on bringing it inwards, you keep on applying, investigating that text. And that's where you realize, actually, that's what these things are for. That's why they're designed in that way. They're not designed to be read. Yeah? They're designed to be recited. They're designed to be internalized, to be reflected on. I believe very strongly that that a religious tradition like ours, Buddhism's one of the great religious traditions of humanity. Religious tradition doesn't exist as an entity. It's not a thing. It's not something which is sort of passed down in this pristine form from generation to generation. That's not what a tradition means. If you look at those things which form the tradition, those things which form the tradition are always living. They're always vital in their time. Yeah? You look at the teaching of Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah wasn't a conformist. He didn't do the things that everybody around him was doing. On the contrary, he completely rebelled against the things. He left the monastery he was at. He walked into the forest. He went from monastery after monastery looking for teachings again and again. Always inquiring, always investigating, always trying to learn. And he did many things. Reformed many things which were quite different and quite the opposite of what was happening in Buddhism around him. If you see in Thailand, if you go to most of the monasteries, you see all the kind of big, beautiful buildings and so on. Whereas in the forest monasteries, usually, at least in the old days, it's always very simple buildings, just functional, simple, clean buildings. In the forest tradition, they would always try to not do lots of rituals. It's a constant battle. If you're in the forest monasteries in Thailand, it's a constant battle. The monks always want to do less rituals, less chanting, funerals, all of these things. Lay people coming and wanting them to do more and more and more and more. And the problem is that the more you don't do them, that means the holier you are. So the more people want you to do it. Yeah. And so he'd always be simplifying things. And actually, you had to make rules about these things in the Ajahn Chah tradition. They made a rule. You know, if you're going to chanting for a funeral, you only go to the house once to do the chanting. Yeah? Often they might ask the monks to go back, say, you know, every day for a week or something like that to do chanting. And Ajahn Chah said, no, we go once, we do the chanting, that's enough. Many of these things, yeah, which were forbidden, yeah, were handing out amulets, these kinds of things. I remember once when I was in south of Thailand, I was staying at a monastery, and somebody gave me some of these little amulets. And as it happened, I was traveling back from, and these things are incredibly popular in Thailand. I was traveling back from there to Bangkok, and I was going to visit my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai. And I thought, I've got these amulets, I can give them to my teacher as a gift. And so I went to see him, and I was very, very pleased to be able to say, you know, here's these amulets. And he just kind of looked at them and said, oh, yeah. He said, you know, enlightened monks don't have amulets. Oh, okay. Very straightforward, yeah. He said, you know, the great forest masters, they never had amulets. He said Ajahn Tate made some amulets once, but Ajahn Mun told him off, so he never did it again. So we shouldn't think of, and these kinds of things are always going on in this tradition. That's what the tradition is formed of. The tradition is formed of these dynamics, these changes, these challenges. Yeah. Again, just another challenge, another change. If you look in Thailand at the nuns or the Mechi in the monasteries in Thailand. Typically, many monasteries, the Mechi exist purely to, their roles purely to do the laundry, cook the food, clean things, build things for the monks. And they have no teaching. They don't give in any meditation instructions. They're given no support. They have to work or supply funds themselves. And that's just how they get by. And Ajahn Chah tried to reform that. And when he set up the nuns' community at his monastery at Wat Pa Phong, he set it up as much as he could. That would be similar. Their lifestyle would be similar to that of the monks. For example, he would give them regular teachings. Go there. And that's kind of unheard of. It's a kind of great innovation. You mean you actually teach the nuns because they can actually practice meditation? It's completely bizarre. And he did things like that. One of the monks' rules in the forest tradition that we don't use money. So he made it the same rule for the Mechis also, that they wouldn't use money and so on. So he didn't make, you know, it wasn't like everything was perfectly equal by any means, but he made, you know, steps towards that, steps towards a greater degree of autonomy and responsibility and ability to practice among the Mechis community. And of course, you know, what we've seen recently, now the tradition has been kind of reversed, and I saw that happening even when I was in Thailand. You know, when I was at Wat Nanachat in 1994 or 95, when I was first there, the nuns used to go for alms round. You know, the white robe nuns would take their bowls and go for alms round with the monks in the village. And it was about 94 or 95. That practice, which had been going on for many years, was stopped. The order came down from the head monastery, no, you can't do that, and the nuns can't go for alms round anymore. So these innovations which Ajahn Chah introduced sort of gradually get kind of rolled back. Yeah, they're kind of the gradual constraints kind of brought back in. It's a long-term process. So each of us has to find that way for ourselves, that way to find the real essence of the Dhamma. And much as, you know, we're given the support by the institutions, by the Buddhist society, by the Sangha and all of these things are giving, and the teachings, the books, all of those externals are giving us some support, some encouragement. But somehow at the end of the day, we're going to be thrown back on our own resources. This is what the Buddha said again towards the end of his life. He said, Atta dīpaṁ viharata bhikkhave, atta saraṇaṁ ananya dīpaṁ ananya saraṇaṁ. He said, dwell with yourselves as a refuge, with yourselves as an island, with no other refuge, with no other island. So remember that when we've come for this week's retreat, you know, we have the teachings, we have the place, we have the rules, we have the meditation method, and all of these are there to give some kind of structure, but that's not where the truth lies. I remember one story I heard once of the Buddha and Mara standing together having a chat. You know, Mara, so the Buddhist Satan. This story is a little bit like the Book of Job, where the kind of God and the devil are having tempting Job or whatever. Anyway, this particular story is not quite as cruel as the story of Job. The Buddha and Mara are sitting together, standing together, having a chat, and they saw a man walking along the path. And he walked along the path. He stopped. And he bent down. He picked up something in front of him. There was something on the path. He bent down, he picked it up. And it was a little piece of the truth which was lying there on the path. And when Mara saw that this man had picked up a piece of the truth, he smiled. And the Buddha said to him, Mara, why are you smiling? He just found a piece of the truth. You're the deluder. You're the master of illusion. Surely you should be scared and frightened that he's found the truth. And Mara said, oh no, don't worry about it. Just give him a few minutes. He'll make a doctrine out of it. So that's just how long it takes, isn't it? Yeah? And again, that's not an exaggeration, is it? You think about it. You think what's happened in your own meditation. Yeah? All of you have done that today. Yeah? Haven't you? You've all sat there in meditation. Something's happened in your meditation. An actual experience, a clearing of the mind, an insight into the truth, a realization of the meditation, and then almost immediately you start thinking, oh, that's this and this. Oh, aren't I good? I've got to this and this stage now. Oh, I've realized that. Oh, this is impermanence. Yeah. And as soon as it happens, we start locking it up in these doctrines. We start burying it. I don't know if many of you have been to visit Bodh Gaya. Yeah. If you haven't, you must. It's a very beautiful and very inspiring thing. But one of the things I learned last time I was at Bodh Gaya, if you've ever been there, you know how you walk along, there's like a promenade with the shops and stalls and things, and then you turn right into the entry to the stupa, the main stupa, and you go down this long flight of stairs, yeah, to go to where the stupa is. Does anyone remember that? Yeah. So, has that ever struck you as being a bit odd? Why do they build a stupa in the low ground? You don't build stupa in the low ground, you build stupa on the high place. Yeah? I didn't actually realize any of that until I was just talking with some people who lived in Bodh Gaya, and they explained that actually, when they had first rediscovered it, that the stupa was almost buried. It was almost completely covered. And that they'd had to dig down to find it. Yeah? Actually, the high part where you walk down off the stairs, that's not the natural ground level. Where the stupa is at is the natural ground level. Where the high part, incidentally, for archaeology buffs, is actually the old Sri Lankan temple. And that whole high area where the markets are and everything is actually an old Sri Lankan vihara, which is still buried, has never been excavated. But I like that as a metaphor. To find the real Buddha, the real place of enlightenment, you have to dig down. Yeah, the Buddha's been covered over, layers and layers of dirt, years and years of all of these things, and you have to dig down and down and down and down to find out where the real place, the real enlightenment happened. So during this retreat, if you feel the urge to throw off all the shackles, you think, okay, I'm just going to walk into the forest and sit in the forest alone, meditation all night, then just do it. If you want to go and hug a tree, go and hug it. If you want to scream out in the middle of the night, just scream. We'll understand, don't worry. I've screamed plenty of times. It's one of the good things about living in really big forest monasteries. No one can hear you scream in the middle of the night. So just remember that. Remember that. And this is the point of the practice, is that those precious moments of truth, those precious moments of realization, and see if we can hold those. See if we can make them real. We can hold them. But without making them into something, without making them into a shrine, without making them into a doctrine. just that, the actual living truth of it. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the experience versus, I guess, versus doctrine, or versus fossilized religion, living religion versus fossilized religion, perhaps. Anyway, if does anyone have any comments or questions? One story in one of Karen Armstrong's first books, she talks about her experience as a Catholic nun, and she was ordained in the last of the kind of the old school of the Catholic, the way that they were brought up in the Catholic tradition. And one of the stories that they told, many stories that were completely outrageous because of the things that they do, but one of them was that in the evening they would sew. Yeah, so they do their sewing, and if you didn't have any, if no one had put any thread in the sewing machine, then you just kept sewing anyway. If you if you told someone that you needed some thread, that was a sign of disobedience, and you weren't really practicing. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So yes, exactly. So the tradition has its own inestimable value. This is, I think, the paradox of it. This is why it's always a dynamic. Yeah, that the in a way, you know, we can't remain trapped by it, but we also have to have that gratitude for it. Yeah, again, this is why I like that story of Ajahn Chah. That, you know, he left the monastery rather than building the sala. But then later on he came back and he built the sala. Yeah? So, oh yeah, well that happened anyway. People do that anyway. Yeah, I mean the Buddhist. I mean, it's probably getting a bit off topic to talk about it too much. But in the Buddhist scriptures, what you see is there's actually a very strong conservative drive. Like there's a very strong desire right from the earliest days to preserve the word of the Buddha in a literal way. From one generation to the next. And at the same time, there's also the desire or the need, which I think is a genuine one, to reinvent or to present that in a way that's going to be relevant and it's going to keep it alive. I think both of those things are needed. So actually, and this is one of the things that when we do text critical studies is one of the things that we find. For example, I'll just give a simple example of that is there's a difference in the Buddhist suttas between the narratives and the teachings. And if you compare the different suttas across all the different versions, very, very often what you find is that the narratives may be quite different, but the actual teachings themselves are the same. So the teaching might be, say, a teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and that will be exactly the same. in every version of a particular script, scripture, but the details, where it was told, who it was told to, what were the events surrounding it and so on, those things will change. So I think the tradition had quite a sense of, again, this notion of distinguishing between what's essential and what's inessential. That's right, the essential teachings remain the same, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it wasn't a matter of thinking it. They absolutely stirred up the Thai tradition. I mean, that caused no end of trouble. I don't know about now, but it did at the time. Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, this is, of course, one of the differences between Ajahn Chah and other teachers. For example, Ajahn Mahabua, when he had Western disciples, he always kept them in his monastery. He told them, you stay here, don't go anywhere. Ajahn Chah would always send the monks away. I don't know if he just found them too annoying or something. But... And eventually they set up the monastery in this village called Bungwai, which is about an hour's walk from Ajahn Chah's monastery. But what happened when they set that up was that they had a strong resistance from the monasteries in the area. And the monks there were attacked quite viciously, and there was a lot of rumours and criticism and so on. And it was on that basis, is we love our Thai ways. Actually, that's what it said. It was a sign on the... Even when I was there, which was nearly 20 years after the monastery had been founded, there was a sign on a local village temple where we would go for alms. And on that village, front of that village temple, there was a sign saying, we love Thai customs. And that was the last remnant of that kind of smear campaign, that the kind of the Westerners were there to destroy the Thai ways and the Thai customs and things like that. So, of course, after a while, they'd been there for a while and people got used to it. But the forest tradition, I mean, that was only one example, but the forest tradition had incredible difficulties and conflicts in Thailand. It's something that we don't hear about very much these days. But the village monks and the city monks hated the forest monks. The local head of what they call the Jakana Ampers, Jakana Jangwat, the head of the local state, the monk who's the head of the state, hated Ajahn Chah, loathed him. And because they're forest monks, they're completely out of control. What are they doing out there in the forest anyway? They should come here in the city and do their exams and you know, do the services for the lay people. That's what monks are supposed to be doing. And what are they out there doing, this voodoo and black magic stuff anyway? And monks aren't supposed to be sitting in huts and meditating. And so this monk, yeah, he really hated Ajahn Chah. And of course, the day came when one of his assistants came to him and said, "Oh, Bhante, the good news is that the king and queen are visiting. The bad news is that they're going to see Ajahn Chah." They had to go along and see them. Yeah. This story is repeated over and over again throughout Thailand, yeah, throughout that history. Yeah. Okay. If there's no more, if anyone doesn't have any more questions, I might just do a couple of have a look at quite a lot of written questions here. I won't get through them all, but I might just do a couple of written questions before we finish. Okay. Is it true when women during their menstrual cycle cannot enter Buddhist temples? I don't know if you've noticed anybody checking on the outside door or anything like that. No, that's not true. It's just another example of these kind of silly customs, actually, not a Buddhist custom, but something which creeps into Buddhism. It's actually a kind of magical or animistic kind of idea, but no, that's not a Buddhist idea. That's an easy one. Oh dear, okay. I'd heard a view that the four Brahma Viharas are somehow somewhat superior to the four jhanas. One support for this being that they are always listed afterwards in the suttas. Is there any justification for this theory? Does entering jhana through the Brahma Viharas feel any different experientially? Well, that's quite a subtle or quite a difficult question. For those of you not familiar with the issues behind that in the suttas, the suttas talk very often about these states of meditation that's called the four jhanas. Now, practice when the four jhanas are described, what's described there is what is the state of consciousness like at that time, what's present in the mind, what's absent in the mind. But the jhanas themselves are not linked with any particular meditation method. Okay? So that according to the Buddhist tradition, actually you can do many different meditation methods, for example, such as breath meditation or metta meditation or concentrating on a light or many different other ones, and they will all lead to jhanas. So even though you're practicing a different method from the beginning, at the end that will lead to the same state of consciousness. So that's the kind of the normal position, normal understanding in Buddhism. But one of the details in the suttas which you find is that when you mention the jhanas and also the four Brahma Viharas, of course being metta, karuna or compassion, mudita or joy, and upekkha or equanimity, when those practices are mentioned side by side, the four Brahma Viharas are always come afterwards. And usually the Buddhist scriptures are quite sequential, so it goes from more coarse things up to more refined things. So kind of could be read as implying somehow that the four Brahma Viharas are superior to the four jhanas. And that's something which is interesting in comparative light also, because in the Pali scriptures you find that situation occasionally. In some other of the early scriptures, especially the Sarvastivada scriptures, that's always the case. The four Brahma Viharas are always mentioned after the four jhanas. So that's the textual situation. What the implications of that are, I think, are uncertain. I think the normal position in Buddhism would be that the method, the means you use for attaining jhanas is not so important. Any one of the methods is suitable, and the main thing is whether you reach that state of purification of mind at the end of the day. I think that's the normal position, and I think in this case it's probably correct. I don't think that there's really any reason to think that the Brahma Viharas necessarily are superior. Although I don't think it's entirely clear cut, but I think that's most likely the case. And do the jhanas kind of experientially feel any different through entering jhana through the different methods? One of the things that you find in meditation, and a few people have actually noticed this already. So, for example, people have compared doing metta meditation with doing breath meditation, and they find that after practicing for a little while, that it actually, you know, it actually can feel quite similar. That the sense of the sort of soft sense of joy that you can get from the breath feels actually very similar to the sense of feeling that you get from metta. So, even though the methods at the beginning are quite different, but they sort of converge. They're all coming towards the same place. And I think that's true generally, and generally speaking, the further you go, the deeper you go into the meditation, the less there are any differences between them. And if there are any differences, they're very minor. It's just as like a, maybe a slight difference in the tone or the feel of it, but no real difference in terms of the clarity and the profundity of the experience. Okay. When sitting outside watching the birds in the trees, am I not being mindful? I don't know, are you? You might be, you might be not. As my attention is focused externally and not within the four foundations internally, it would seem I am being mindful. No? So it seems I'm being unmindful. And yet at these times I feel connected to the world around me. Yes, of course, that's fine. The Buddha said contemplate internally and externally, not just internally. Yeah? Ajatang and Bahidha, always in the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about this again and again and again. One contemplates internally, one contemplates externally. And so the whole point of it is simply that you're aware of that, you're mindful of that. If you're contemplating externally, you're mindful of that. You're contemplating internally, you're mindful of that. And I think it's actually very important to do this, yeah, and to exercise our awareness and our mindfulness in all of these different spheres. Okay, so question here: what's the difference between a mantra and using the words "May I be happy"? The difference is essentially that. When we're using a mantra, like say in Hindu meditation and so on, they use the mantra Om, or you maybe use the word Buddha or something as a mantra in Buddhism. Essentially, you're focusing on the sound. Yeah, actually, the mantra Om in Hinduism, you're quite explicitly focusing on the sound of that word. It's the word itself which is the object. In the Christian meditation tradition, the most common meditation word they use is Maranatha, which is an Aramaic word, which means "Come to me, O Lord." But actually, if you know Sanskrit, you know Maranatha means "Satan is Lord." So don't tell your Christian friends that, all right? So. When you're doing the metta meditation, yes, we're doing the "May I be happy," so you have the words there, which is there in a way similar to a mantra, but the words are there to point to the feeling. So the actual object of the metta meditation is the feeling of metta, it's not the words. So you come from the words, but the words are pointing to the feeling. Yeah? So that's a slight difference. The words themselves are not the object. I mean, we take the words as the object right in the beginning when you're first developing it, but when the feeling comes, then the feeling becomes the object and not the words itself. So that's the difference there. That's probably enough. I'll leave these other questions for tomorrow. Maybe for this evening we can just finish up by paying respects to the Triple Gem.